Okay, well, thanks first of all to the organizers for putting together such an interesting mix of different topics. This is going to be a significant departure from what you've heard about so far. So I'm going to tell you about some joint work that was sort of a PI broad collaboration. So this is Ellie Wolf, who's a postdoc at Perimeter, Belen Sains and Ravi Kunjwal, who until recently were postdocs here, and this is David Schmidt, my student. And this is our joint project. The connection to the topic of the conference is to the question of resources for computing. So I would say it's probably totally uncontroversial that any computational advantages we see over classical theories, what classical theories would offer, has to arise in some sense from a resource of non-classicality. But the thing about which there isn't consensus is sort of how should we conceptualize the notion of non-classicality that's at play in computation? What's the right way to think about non-classicality? So this is a couple of desiderata you might want that notion to have. So first of all, it should be such that at the end of the day, you should be able to say what the necessary and sufficient conditions for computational advantage are. So you don't want to just know, I have something that's necessary for computational advantage. You'd like to know precisely what's being used for the computational advantage. And secondly, I think you should have a unified account of computational advantage, which is independent of the computational model. So you don't just want a notion of what's the resource here in the state injection model, or over here in the circuit model, or in the measurement-based computing model. You'd like to have a big picture notion of non-classicality, which you can then particularize to all these models and say, yes, in each case, it's the same notion of non-classicality that's at work. So that's ultimately what you'd like. And I'm not going to solve these problems. We're really going to take just sort of small steps. So first of all, what's the notion of non-classicality that's going to be kind of the defining one for this project? It's the one that is witnessed by the failure to explain operational statistics within a classical ontological framework for describing causal structure and Bayesian inferences. What does that mean? Well, I could give hours of talks about that, so it's not so important, but I'm coming at it from a sort of quantum foundations point of view as to what's the essence of non-classicality. And roughly speaking, it has to do with the theory used to do Bayesian inference in a way that respects causal structure. But it's not really going to be that relevant for the purposes of this talk. What's important is that local causality, so Bell's notion of local causality, and generalized non-contextuality, so this is a generalization of the Cauchon-Specker notion of non-contextuality to make it a bit more operational, something I proposed back in 2005. So those, I argue, are both natural features of the sorts of classical explanations that I have in mind. And therefore, when they fail, if you have some operational statistics that fails Bell's notion of local causality or fails to admit of one of these generalized non-contextual models, well, that's an example of the type of non-classicality that I think is at play in these computational advantages. So that's the perspective I'm going to take. That failures of these guys are good examples of the kind of non-classicality we want. And therefore, a good first step towards the ultimate goal of understanding resources for advantages in computing would be to develop a resource theory of non-classicality in, say, prepare and measure scenarios. So that's usually where we talk about proofs of contextuality. I have some multi-party system that's being prepared in some way and then subjected to one of a set of measurements, and we look at the statistics in that experiment. And those statistics either do or do not admit of a non-contextual model. And so, roughly speaking, this would be to try to, the simplest example of a resource theory of contextuality. And actually, that's where our collaborative project started. We were thinking, all right, let's do that. And then we'll work our way towards, questions about computation. But it turned out there's a lot of subtleties with defining that. And so on the way, we got sort of sidetracked on a simpler project, which is develop a resource theory of non-classicality in Bell scenarios. So in the case of Bell experiments where it's local causality that fails. And then we were able to sort of, I think to our satisfaction, figure out what the right way to define the resource theory there is. And so that's what I'm telling you about today. All right, we're still working on the first project, but that's not gonna contextuality is not gonna feature anymore in this talk. It's all gonna be about this notion of non-classicality. Okay, so how are we gonna think about non-classicality in Bell scenarios? Well, there's lots of ways you might have approached developing a resource theory in a Bell scenario. And the conceptual perspective you have on, you know, what is non-classical about a Bell experiment really will determine the way you develop your resource theory, the way you define it. So I need to tell you a fair bit about the kind of perspective we take on the Bell scenario, such that it'll make sense how we define our resource theory. And you know, along the way, I'm going to try to make a case for this causal inference perspective also being useful for maybe certifying whether there's something quantum going on in a particular computational architecture. Okay, so causal inference is this subfield of machine learning, and it tries to figure out what causes what based on the correlations. So let me just jump in and tell you a little bit about the formalism of causal inference. So you can define what's called a causal model. It has two components, the causal structure. So over here, you have a directed acyclic graph. So the arrows, so the nodes represent just random variables. The arrows represent one variable having a direct causal influence on another. And there are no cycles. So you know, you shouldn't have grandfather paradoxes, that sort of thing. And then you supplement the model with these, well, called causal statistical parameters. So for every variable like x, you specify the probability distribution over its values for every set of values of its parents, in this case, s and capital lambda. And similarly for y, and any variables that don't have parents, you just specify how they're distributed. And then you can show that the overall distribution of all the variables in the graph will just be the products of those conditionals. Okay, another thing you can imagine is situations where you know the causal structure, but there's some variables that are not observed. So I'm going to use a circle to represent a variable that's not observed. Triangles are variables that are observed. So now I get a joint distribution over just the observed variables by summing over the unobserved variable. Okay, so basically there'll be some limits on the sorts of distributions I can see here for that sort of causal structure. And we want techniques for finding those constraints for any causal structure. So you know, here's another example. This is called the instrumental scenario. The machine learning guys are interested in this one in particular. And so it's the same thing. You specify the probabilities for every variable given its parents. You put them together. In this case, mu is unobserved. You get some set of joint distributions on the observed variables that are compatible with that assumption about the causal structure. Here's another example that we've studied a lot. Here, so you have three observed variables, A, B, C, and every pair of them has a common cause acting on it, but there's no three-way common cause for the triple. And so you get interesting constraints on the joint distributions in that case. All right, well, for the case of the Bell scenario, we're really gonna focus on this causal structure because that's the one that's actually relevant for Bell-type experiments. And so if you ask, what are the kinds of constraints that arise for example, this conditional x, y given st, so these are the settings and the outcomes. Well, one constraint is equality constraints, which are just conditional independences. So the outcome x is independent of the setting t, even if you condition on the setting s. These are sometimes called no signaling constraints in the quantum context. But we're not gonna be so interested in these equality constraints. For us, the more interesting ones are the inequality constraints. So this joint distribution satisfies inequalities like this one here, which is just a particular way of writing out the CHSH inequality. All right, so from this causal inference perspective, this is just an example of a constraint that this any distribution of this sort compatible with this causal structure, so that could have arisen from it, must satisfy. Okay, now what does it look like geometrically? Suppose I draw in a some space, all the possible distributions x, y given st. So that's some big polytope. So that's what these dashed lines represent. I'm just looking at a corner of that polytope. This is just a caricature. Well, then the equality constraints are like hyperplanes that slice through that polytope and force you to be in some region. So that's like these no signaling constraints in this case. But the inequalities mean that you can't be anywhere inside that hyperplane. You're inside some specific region. So this CHSH inequality, for example, could be, you know, you have to be on the left-hand side of this hyperplane here, and so there's other inequalities that force you to be this polytope. So that's often called the Bell polytope. Okay, so that's a pretty familiar story about Bell correlations. Now, the connection to quantum mechanics is that, you know, we can do experiments wherein, you know, these S and T variables are the settings and the X and Y are the outcomes. And there's some pair of entangled particles which are like the common cause that go off. And we can see these kinds of correlations, xy given st. And this is an example of correlations that you can realize in a quantum experiment and that violate those Bell inequalities. And so you know that that must be incompatible with this causal structure. There's no set of parameters I could add to this that would give me these kinds of statistics. Okay, and yet, so you might think, all right, well, let's throw some causal influences from S to Y in, for example. That'll allow me to violate those Bell inequalities. But if you've done the experiment in a way that things are space-like separated, you expect that there are no causal influences. So relativity theory suggests that you shouldn't allow those sorts of influences. And furthermore, in some old work with Chris Wood, I showed that if you don't want your model to be fine-tuned, then you also can't allow causal influences. Roughly speaking, if you put a causal influence in to explain Bell inequality violations, then you really need to fine-tune the parameters to make sure you can't use that to send signals faster than the speed of light. And this no fine-tuning principle is something that the causal inference community typically uses to pick out what are good causal explanations and what are bad causal explanations. So it really seems like you have to have the common cause structure. Relativity theory suggests that. And yet, you still want a causal explanation. So you're sort of at an impasse. Bell's theorem tells you can't have your common cause explanation. Relativity theory tells you can't have causal influences. So what do you do? So the proposal, which is going to be sort of the basis of what comes next, is that you imagine generalizing the notion of a causal model. Okay, so the generalization of the causal structure is going to be kind of mild. It's going to allow for these unobserved variables to become more exotic, unobserved quantum systems. The observed variables are still all going to be classical. But it's the causal structure that's natural. It's the one that relativity theory says should hold. So in the Bell experiment, it's going to be this kind of causal structure. But what changes is that rather than throwing in conditional probabilities as the way you would represent your incomplete information about some of these variables, you have these more exotic objects, which I'll call, say, conditional density operators or conditional states, and they're operators on a tensor product of Hilbert spaces associated with each of these systems. So that framework, I'm not going to go into much detail. It's described in this first paper. But you can use it to compute a kind of density operator for the observed guys, which is, again, as long as these systems are classical, it's going to be diagonal in some basis for those systems. And so just as over here, I could compute the conditional probability for some particular values of x, y, s, and t, little x, little y, little s, little t, by plugging them in. Similarly here, I can take this operator and find its expectation value relative to that special basis that defines the classical basis and get a probability distribution. Okay, so I haven't really given you the details of how this works, but roughly speaking, the idea is that there should be some sort of quantum generalization of the framework of Bayesian inference that we use to make inferences when we have incomplete information. What's interesting is that if you do that, then you can violate the Bell inequalities to precisely the extent that quantum theory requires, whereas these, with these probabilities, of course, you can't. You'll just satisfy the Bell inequalities. All right, well, it turns out that there's been many proposals for how to do a quantum generalization of these causal models. And let me tell you a slightly different way of thinking about it, which moves from these directed acyclic graphs, which people typically use in the causal inference literature, to circuits, because those will be a bit more natural to us. So I can draw the classical circuit this way. I can say, oh, there's some distribution over a pair of these latent or hidden variables, lambda A and lambda B. And then x depends on lambda A and s, and y depends on lambda B and t. And I put it together in this formula, and that's how I get my observed statistics. And that'll give me exactly the kinds of correlations I could see in the previous model. For example, I could just prepare some lambda and make two copies of it and send it out. So it's a totally equivalent way of describing the classical causal model. And similarly, on the quantum side, I can imagine that the common cause is just preparing a bipartite quantum state over A and B, and now X depends only on A and Y depends only on B. And again, I'm going to use these conditional density operators to represent it. And again, it gives the same thing as what I showed you on the previous slide, but it looks a bit more familiar now that it's a bipartite state that's being measured on the two sides. So various people have suggested this as the right definition of a quantum causal model. And so here's some papers that give various suggestions. And there are differences between different approaches, but the differences aren't going to be relevant for this talk. They're not going to be relevant for questions that we're asking here about what sorts of correlations we can see. And therefore, I'm just going to use this sort of approach here, where it's just a bipartite state, for example, that's being measured in different ways. So this still looks a bit unfamiliar, so I'll make it look even more familiar. All that those other conditionals were doing were defining POVMs whose outcomes were X, S labeled which POVM you're measuring on A. So I could write it like this. This is a POVM on A. You know, for every value of S, you get a different POVM. X is the outcome. Similarly for B. And then, you know, the formula for computing the probabilities is just the standard Born rule. Okay, so I've just rewritten it in a more conventional terminology or notation. And that's, for this particular case, that's what a quantum causal model is. But, you know, having the broader perspective is important for figuring out in other causal structures what a quantum causal model would look like. Okay, so the idea here is that we're going to think of the non-classicality as the move, you know, the change in the causal structure. There's basically no change in the overall structure, but I've changed from probabilities to more exotic quantum formalism. And that's where the non-classicality comes from. Now, I need to mention something else. There's a formalism called generalized probabilistic theories. That's a way of trying to describe things that are post-quantum. And in that framework, you replace quantum states by real-valued vectors on some vector space, and POVMs are replaced by sets of real-valued vectors. The Born rule looks very similar. And you can compute probabilities in these, you know, lots of people have studied these generalized probabilistic theories. And if you think of the generalized probabilistic theory as just being something you add on to a causal model, add on to a causal structure, that was proposed in these two papers, you can think of post-quantum causal models, you know, causal models that don't necessarily respect quantum theory and allow for even more general sorts of correlations. All right, so what happens? Here's the slide I showed you before about in the Bell scenario, what a classical causal model would predict. You get these Bell inequality constraints on the distributions. If I allow the causal model to go quantum, well, now those Bell inequalities can be violated. So I can get more correlations than I would see in the classical causal model. But I still get constraints. So there's Cyrilson inequality constraints, like this one here, same left-hand side as the Bell inequality. But now the bound is up to 85% rather than 75%. And you get, this is just one example. You get many of these inequalities. And if your conditional independence relations, by the way, still hold in the quantum model. If you go to generalized probabilistic theories, your conditional independence relations still hold. Now you can violate some of those Cyrilson inequalities. And then you can ask, well, are there any more constraints? And the answer is no. Basically, anything that satisfies these equality constraints is allowed in this kind of causal model. That was shown by John Barrett. Okay, so that's the situation with the familiar Bell scenario. This is what it looks like relative to that geometric picture I showed you before. So there's my Bell inequality constraint. There's the Bell polytope. Now the quantum one is like this green region. There's some Cyrilson inequality constraints, like maybe this hyperplane here. I have to be on this side of it. And the red region is all the things that I could access in one of these GPT causal models. So there it's the whole intersection of this thing with the hyperplane that picks out these equality constraints. So that's how we're used to thinking. This is for many people who work on non-locality. This is a very familiar story. But it becomes less familiar when you deviate from the causal structure that we're used to thinking about, the one that dictates the Bell experiment. So let me tell you a little bit about that. I already said this. Okay. So first of all, you know, what's the scope of possibilities for generalization? Well, this is the Bell causal structure. I showed you the triangle, the instrument scenario. Here's another one. Here's a bunch more. All of these probably have gaps between what's classically and quantum allowed. You know, in some cases, we don't have proofs. But I think it's likely that all of them will show such gaps. And you know, there's an infinite number of such causal structures. So when you think about it that way, you know, we have a lot of work to do, that we know the Bell structure well. But in all these cases, we want to know precisely what's the classical set of correlations, what can I get to with quantum, and is there a gap? And anytime there's a gap, maybe there's a potential for a quantum advantage in some sort of information processing task. which is somehow governed by this causal structure. There's been a lot of work done on causal structures that are different from the Bell scenario and the kinds of inequalities that might describe constraints that come from classicality. Here's an incomplete list of such work. And I just want to give you a flavor for how it works. So I'm going to zoom in on a particular example, so this triangle scenario, where the observed variables A, B, and C are four-valued. Okay, so this is what the directed acyclic graph looks like. This is what the circuit looks like. So A, B, and C are here, and you can see that there's sort of a common cause acting on every pair of them, but no joint three-way common cause. So to innovate to the quantum, I just allow these things to now be pairs of quantum systems distributed to each of the two nodes. Okay, so you say, well, what are the constraints on the classical model? In this case, there's none of these equality constraints, no conditional independences. But you still get Bell-type inequalities. So this is a relatively simple inequality that Elie Wolff derived with his code. So there's a paper here by myself, Elie, and Tobias Fritz that introduces a technique for deriving these types of inequalities for arbitrary causal structures. And remember, A is four-valued, so it's split up here into a pair of bits, A left and A right, and similarly with B and C. So this is a kind of inequality you can derive in this structure. This one comes from this paper by T.C. Fraser and Elie. And there's many more like that. And then if you promote to a quantum causal model, well, those Bell-type inequalities can now be violated, and you get new inequalities. And unfortunately, this happens not to be one that they've kind of run the code on, so I can't give you a specific example, but it'll look like the last example, and I just didn't want to make Elie have to do the derivation just for the purposes of my talk. So fill in your mind a complicated looking inequality here. And if you're interested, go take a look at this nice paper that Elie and his collaborators put out recently on how to derive those inequalities for quantum causal models with arbitrary causal structure. Okay, and then same sort of story. Those inequalities can again be violated if you now move to a generalized probabilistic theory causal model. And now here's the interesting thing. If you ask, are there constraints on those causal models, the answer comes back yes. Unlike the Bell scenario, where there were no extra constraints beside the equality ones, here you get non-trivial inequality constraints. So in this causal structure, there's a kind of monogamy. Even if I let these common causes be post-quantum, it's still the case that the amount of correlation between A and B and between A and C is limited. They can't, for example, all be perfectly correlated with another. So the sum of those correlations are bounded by the entropy in A. And so I think that's really interesting. So part of the standard picture for Bell scenarios just falls down here. There's really inequalities, constraints that come just from the causal structure itself, regardless of what theory governs how you make inferences relative to that.
Remind me what the orange circles mean. I thought they were like quantum causes, but you seem to be
saying. In this talk, they mean both quantum and possibly GPT. Like they could be
okay,
also these post-quantum things.
Okay.
Sorry, yeah, I didn't introduce any notational distinction, but I should have. Okay. So the picture then is more complicated. So the red region is now stuff that you can only get to with one of these GPT causal models. The green is quantum. The blue is classical, so the red doesn't fill necessarily the hyperplane of things that you get through the equality constraints. And notice that these things now are highly non-convex. And so the problem of deriving these inequalities becomes a lot harder. And the standard techniques for deriving Bell inequalities, which were always sort of like facets of some simple polytope, they don't go through. Yes?
Polytopes go out the window?
Yep.
I mean, these things look smooth. These boundaries?
Well, this is just a cartoon. Some of these might be smooth boundaries, others might be flat. But yes, polytopes are out the window because in this kind of causal structure here, like let's say I take the classical case, where is it? Here. I have like three hidden variables, for example. And now if I try to eliminate that freedom, it's not a single source of randomness, it's many, and so it appears non-linearly in the equations that define valid distributions, and that's why everything becomes non-convex. Okay, so hopefully I've given you some flavor of how this is a very non-trivial extension of the usual story of what the boundary between classical and non-classical is. It requires new techniques to pick out these boundaries for arbitrary causal structures. And there's, as I say, a lot of work being done on that. All right, so that ends my summary of what the causal inference perspective on Bell's theorem, where it leads you in terms of how you think about the boundary between classical and non-classical. It's a boundary of explainability by some causal model. So now let's bring it to resources for computation. How is it that, you know, this, like Bell scenarios, for example, and non-classicality in Bell scenarios connects to computation? So Robert, this should look familiar. If you take a...
I should point out, this is from a paper this by is, Dan Brown.
Thank you, yes.
Janet Anders.
They'll be referenced on the next slide. You probably all know this. This is a measurement-based model for computation where you have some correlated resource and a control computer.
From a famous paper.
So here are the classical inputs, classical outputs of your computational problem. And then at each site, you send information, which you can think of as the setting of a measurement, and you get some outcome, and you feed it through in the control computer. And so usually we think about this as being a kind of quantum resource, and this as being a computer that can do universal classical computation. But in this interesting paper by Dan Brown and Jenna Anders, they said, well, let's consider something else where the control computer is not universal classical computation. Thank you. It's just linear gates. So it can do NOTs and XORs, but no nonlinear gates, so nothing like an AND gate. And they showed that in that model, if you have things that violate Bell inequalities, you can promote the power of your classical computer beyond these linear gates. So in particular, if I use correlations here that are of what's called Popescu-Rohrlich boxes, so they're a bit like those quantum correlations I showed you earlier, but now everything's cleaned up, there's zero probabilities here. So for those kinds of correlations, you can use this to get AND gates, and the way to see it is that this pattern just tells me that the XOR of the outputs, X and Y, is just the product of the inputs, S and T. So these are imagined as binary variables now, taking value 0 or 1. And so if I have two inputs, and I want to calculate their AND, that's just the product of those binary variables. So I turn those inputs into S and T, I get outcomes X and Y, and then I just do the XOR on them, right? So that's allowed among my linear gates. But their XOR is just the product of S and T, so it's the product of the inputs. So now this thing has computed an AND gate, and it's this PR box resource that's allowed it to do that. It's promoted its power from linear gates to nonlinear gates. Okay, so the idea here is that if you tell me something about your computational architecture, then maybe a way of asking whether it's doing something intrinsically non-classical, even though that's what it's doing might not be computationally interesting. You know, like we can you know, figure out AND gates without having to do it, you know, with a Bell inequality violation. But to figure out whether it's doing something intrinsically non-classical, you have to just see where the operational statistics it generates can be explained by a causal model that respects the causal structure of your experiment, and that is classical. So, you know, in the previous example, if I restricted you to classical resources with that structure, you could not promote your gates from linear to nonlinear. So that's the sense. If somebody does it and you can see what the causal structure of the experiment is, you can say something non-classical is going on here because you couldn't have done this with this causal structure if you didn't have any quantumness or post-quantumness. That's the idea. So I think these sort of quantum causal models might be a nice way of trying to settle questions about certifying quantumness, right? So if you have some particular architecture you're interested in, like D-Wave or what have you, and the question you want to answer is not, are they doing something computationally useful, but is there any evidence that there's something intrinsically quantum going on here? And I think a useful approach is, let's look at the causal structure and ask, is it possible to explain what we've seen with that causal structure if it's classical? Okay. So that's the first point. Now, for the rest, it's going to be faster. I'm going to say, what can we say about now quantifying the amount of non-classicality? So thus far, I've just been talking about defining the boundary between what we should call classical and what we should call non-classical, and maybe certifying the presence of non-classicality. And now we want to answer questions like, well, can we quantify how much non-classicality we have for some given set of operational statistics? So that's what I want to do now. So for that, I need to tell you a little bit about resource theories. So I'm going to use a particular framework for resource theories. So this is a paper by myself and Tobias Fritz and Bob Kuka. And the idea is, it's meant to be very abstract, so it can cover lots of different things. So it's a process theory. So you have to define a process theory. So there's different types of systems, which here I'll just label by different letters. There are different processes. So the processes could be, for example, preparations of a system, so like a state, or they could be channels from one system to another type of system. The process theory is closed under parallel and sequential composition. So as long as the types are matched, I can, you know, do a process on a state if the types match. And that's another valid process. I can put them in parallel. So that's what a process theory is. And now to do a resource theory, we just identify some particular sub-theory of free processes, and the rest are non-free, right? So to define a resource theory, you need to tell me which of all these processes, which of them should I think of as being free? And they're going to have to continue to be closed under parallel and sequential composition, so you can't just arbitrarily choose a subset. It has to have the structure itself of a process theory. It's a sub-theory of the original theory. So the idea is that a resource theory is a partitioned process theory. So it's a process theory T that picks out a sub-theory of free processes, which I'm here calling T-free. That's the idea. So when you've got such a thing, then you can immediately start talking about when it's the case that some state, for example, R, can go to some state S under the free operations. And the answer is just, can I find a free object of the right type that will convert this into this? So in this case, it has to be a channel of with input A and output B. And similarly, when I talk about channels, can I go from F to G? Well, again, I just find the right type of operation to take a channel to it. Channel from A to B to a channel from C to D, and I only allow it to be free, and I ask whether I can find an example that'll take F to G. And it's, I can change types. I can say, can this state go to this channel? Oh, just find the appropriate type of free operation that takes it there. So it's a very generic framework that allows you to talk not just about conversions and orders among states, but conversions and orders among lots of different types of objects. And that's important because, in teleportation, we're converting entangled states into channels, things like that. So we need to be able to have that freedom. Okay, so when you consider all those conversion relations, you ask, can R1 go to R2 for free? If yes, I put an arrow between them in this sort of diagram. I get a pre-order, right? So R3 could be above R3 prime, and R3 prime could be above R3, meaning that I can go this way and I can go that way. I can find free operations that do both. If I then quotient relative to those equivalent resources, I get a partial order, right? So now, these are just equivalence classes of the pre-order. And this is really the basic structure of a resource theory. You want to know for all your types of resource, how are they ordered? What's at the top? What's the free stuff is at the bottom? This is really the fundamental object. And so you want to ask questions about it, like, is it a total order? Is it the case that I can take all my resources and just put them in a chain? And, this one's the best, and we can order them. Or is it not totally ordered? It's so that there are incomparable elements that I can't go from one to the other or back again. That's a really important question about any resource theory. You might want to know, is the pre-order weak? That means it's weak if the incomparability relation is transitive. So if A is incomparable with B and B is incomparable with C, then A and C are incomparable. You might also want to know whether it is of infinite height. Do I have an infinite number of different resources in a chain? Its width is about whether, how many elements will I have in an anti-chain, a bunch of things that are incomparable with one another. And then there's this property of local finiteness. These are all global properties of resource theory that you might want to know about. And so I'm going to answer these sorts of questions for our resource theory. All right, finally, the thing that people have often focused on is measures of a resource. So, what's a resource monotone? If R1 goes to R2 for free, then the monotone has to be greater on greater or equal value on R1 than it is on R2. So standard definition for any resource theory. You can just think of it as M has to respect the partial order of the resources. Now here's the thing that I think for a lot of the history of resource theories, people kind of thought that their job was to find the right monotone, the best monotone, the one that'll answer all the questions. But as soon as you realize that the resource theory is really a partial order, you see that there is no best monotone. Like here's a perfectly valid monotone. So R1 takes one value, R2 is a smaller value, R3 is a smaller value than that, so on going down. And here's M2, which orders R3 and R2 differently from their ordered here, but both of them respect the partial order. Now, only if the partial order were itself a total order could I get away with specifying one monotone. I need to have more than one monotone if I'm going to try to capture the structure of that partial order. So the lesson is that don't go looking for the one measure to rule them all. As long as your resource theory is a partial order, there's going to be many monotones that are valid. Yes?
Is it obvious how many monotones you need to?
No, that's a difficult question in any resource theory. And the answer in our case is going to be at least 8. So you'll see. So anyways, what do you really want, therefore? You want a family of monotones that's complete in the sense that it characterizes your preorder. So if you have a set of monotones now, labeled by I, then you want an if and only if, that R1 goes to R2 for free, if and only if for all those monotones, R1 has a larger value than R2. So that's a worthwhile thing to go looking for, a complete set of monotones, not just, you know, one monotone that looks good. You want a complete set. All right, how do you build these things? Well, there's standard constructions. I'm going to use a couple of constructions. So this is a yield construction. So for any resource R, it says, you know, specify a function f. It doesn't itself have to be a monotone. Any old function over the resources. And some set of resources s. And then you can ask, all right, what's the biggest value of f I could see in a resource that I can obtain from R? So R star is something that I can get for free from R in the set S. So I just say, of all the things I can get to in the set S from R, which one of them takes the biggest value of F? That's the yield as quantified by F in the set S. You can prove very easily that that is a monotone in your resource theory. And you also get cost constructions, where again, you specify a set of resources and a function F. And now you ask, what's the minimum value of F for a resource that's in S that can generate R? So of all the things that can generate R that come from this set S, what's the smallest value that this function F can take among them? So that's a cost-based construction. So these are very generic. In any resource theory, you can write this sort of thing down. There's some nuance about what happens if no resource in S can be obtained from R. Well, then just make this thing minus infinity. And if no resource in S can go to R, make this plus infinity. That solves that problem. And let me note that R can be of any type. It doesn't have to be of the same type as the things in this special set S. Because we have a resource theory where we can change types. So I can say R is some complicated thing, but I want to ask about its conversions to some simple type of thing. That's fine. OK, so if you're interested in this, go see a paper by Tomasz Gonda that should be on the archive soon. All right, so now I've done all the hard work. Now I can tell you about our resource theory. So how do you define it? We're going to look at the case of a two-party network, Alice and Bob, and there's a common cause acting on them. That's it. What's the enveloping theory that defines sort of the space of things we might be interested in, sort of the process theory? It's just going to be the quantum processes that are compatible with this structure, or maybe the generalized probabilistic processes, if you're interested in that. And the free stuff is the one that are going to be classical. Just all the classical things that have that structure are free. So for example, if I take resources that are of the same sort of type as, you know, the Popescu-Rohrlich box, or what are often called non-local boxes, so classical inputs, classical outputs, the enveloping theory are things that can be obtained by quantum common causes, joint quantum states, and the free stuff is the one where I can get away with shared randomness, okay, just two classical variables distributed among the parties in some way. So I represent classical by single lines and quantum by double lines. Okay, so these are the things that live in the big theory, and these are the free things. Take another example. Say you're interested in bipartite states. Well, these are the quantum states. What are the things that are of the right type? Well, they're still quantum states, but to be free, they have to be prepared by a classical common cause. So that's just the space of separable states. So the free things in this, the state type are the separable states. These are what you might call the kind of local realistic Bell type experiments, the one that admit of a local model. And if I look at channels, two quantum inputs to two quantum outputs, is the same. I need a classical common cause. So there's a subset of two quantum to two quantum channels that involve only classical common causes. Those are the ones we're allowing for free in this resource theory. Okay, let's go something a bit more exotic. Take a process that's this kind of comb structure. What does it do? It takes these boxes with ST inputs, XY outputs, and transforms them to another box. Well, the most generic thing is some quantum common cause between all these local processings. And the classical thing is when that common cause is just classical. Okay, so these are in the enveloping theory. These are in the free theory. And now we can very easily answer our question of if our resources are themselves boxes, this is the type of resource we're interested in, and we want to know what can I transform one of these two for free, Well, I just throw it into one of the free processings that takes it to another box. So, you know, this resource can transform into anything such that all this stuff, you know, these common causes are classical, because that's the free stuff, right? So very simple. We now know what the free operations are for defining an order over these sorts of objects. It's things of this type. Now note that this, you know, cause that goes over here, well, I could just throw that into this box because there's no restriction on the cardinality of this variable. So let me do that and just say it goes into this box and that goes through forward. And so it can look a bit simpler. And it's basically just, you know, shared randomness between the two parties. They don't need shared randomness at late times because, again, they can always just feed that forward and use it later. So this covers any shared randomness that they need. Okay, so at the end of the day, what we've come up with is that the free operations on these boxes should be local operations and shared randomness. So people had proposed this already as the right way to define a resource theory of non-locality. However, there were many other papers that proposed different alternatives to this, and some where there were sort of nuanced differences between this. But this, I think, is the right choice. The motivations in these articles are quite different from the ones I've given you here. And it's the one we're going to use. Now, in the interest of time, I was going to say a little bit about how to generalize this to those other causal scenarios, you know, besides just the Bell scenario. And I didn't think I was going to have time, and I was right, so I'm just going to skip over a few slides and show you the results about this resource theory. So you can also define what the free operations are in these other kinds of causal structures. And they look very similar. It's just the free operations just have to be classical and respect the causal structure. All right. So this is our set of free operations. Here's an interesting thing. If you ask which among these LOSR operations are deterministic, the answer is, okay, well, they're the ones that don't use any of the shared randomness. And so I can just imagine the setting variables getting copied. One determines what the value of S is going to be. Another goes forward together with X, determines the value of X prime. So these we'll call the local deterministic operations. And it's very easy to see that the LOSR operations are just the convex hull of those guys. Okay, so if you just take mixtures of those guys, you'll get the full set. Because all the shared randomness did was allow you to choreograph the choices of deterministic functions on the right with the choices of deterministic functions on the left. Okay, so we know that that's what LOSR for some type moving to some other type is. And therefore, a resource R1 goes to R2 if and only if R2 is in the convex hull of the images of R1 under these local deterministic operations. So I can process R1 by these local deterministic operations. LOSR is just all mixtures of local deterministic operations. So it's just, you know, consider all the places you could get to from these deterministic operations, and then all the places you could get to by mixing those images together. That will be everywhere you can get to by LOSR. And now this problem is quite easy. The cardinality of these deterministic operations is finite, right? If I go back, there's only so many, like if these are bits, for example, there's only so many bit-to-bit functions. And so I can just count out the number of local deterministic operations. I can use standard packages that are about finding the facets of the convex hull of something. Those I can then test those inequalities and determine whether R1 does indeed go to R2. So there's a linear program that decides convertibility. We describe it in the paper. So that's nice. It now means that, you know, for any two boxes that you might be interested in, Bell type experiments, we can say whether one is above the other in this order. You know, is there some LOSR processing that takes one to the other? Or maybe are they incomparable? We can decide that. But as I said earlier, you're kind of interested in these global properties of the preorder. And it's very difficult to sort of run through all possible pairs of resources. That would be a brute force approach, and it would never end. So you need something a bit more sophisticated. And that's where the monotones come in, if you really want to figure out these global properties. So that's the last bit of the story. So resource monotones for non-classicality of these things. Let me focus in on the simplest case, where these are all binary values. And I'll define a special set of boxes, which are all the ones of that type that arise in a generalized probabilistic theory. So this includes PR boxes, for example. And then I just use this CHSH function as my F in that generic construction. So this is the standard sort of thing we look at. And you note, first of all, that itself is not a monotone, because, for example, I can take something that is below the CHSH inequality and move it to something that has a larger value just by, you know, changing the values of some outputs in this Bell experiment. So it is not itself a monotone, but you just optimize over transformations on it to make it a monotone. So it's just an example of that yield construction where the function is CHSH, the set of things you're mapping to is sort of all these 2-2-2-2 type boxes in a GPT. And so I just say, what's the biggest value of CHSH inequality violation you can see when you've transformed your resource into anything else? So that's the first monotone. It's not hard to prove that's a monotone in the theory. It works for any type of resource, not necessarily these simple ones. And now here's the non-trivial one that we came up with, which is a little bit more complicated. It's the cost, again, measured in the value of this CHSH function. It's the cost in terms of what I'll call degraded PR boxes. So you say, is there a kind of noisy version of a PR box that can to which I can convert to my resource, from which I can obtain my resource? So out of all the resources that are sort of noisy PR boxes, find one that gets me to my resource of interest, and then find the minimum value of the CHSH function among those guys. So the noisy PR boxes are like just the PR box added with essentially a PR box that has become local. I've added so much noise that it's now kind of free. It's in the set that I can generate with a classical common cause. And this is the definition of that noisiest PR box. So this is just a chain of resources, and I'm asking about the cost along that chain. All right, so we are able to find closed form expressions for those guys. And this is a simple picture of the kind of thing that emerges. So here's a two parameter family of these boxes. At the top, the PR box. Over here, if I add noise to the PR box symmetrically till it becomes local, that's this point. So this is the chain of noisy PR boxes along this side. And this is some other resource that's also local. It can be explained by a classical common cause. And it's on the boundary of the things that are in this class of generalized probabilistic causal models. So it's like it saturates these no signaling constraints. In any case, I mean, you don't really need to know what these are. The point is that here's a two parameter family. I've drawn in the level sets for our two monotones. So blue, as I go up this way, is increasing the value of the first monotone, this CHSH one. And the orange, as I move this way, is increasing the value of that second one. And so you immediately see what the global properties of the preorder are. So for example, you can immediately say that it's not a total preorder because I can find pairs of resources, like say R2 and R3, that are incomparable. So R3 has a greater value of the first monotone than R2 does. R2 has a greater value of the second monotone than R3 does, right? Because it's on, you know, this line rather than this line. So they're incomparable. So you know it's not a total preorder. It's something more complicated. The incomparability relation is not transitive because you can show that this is incomparable to this, this is incomparable to this, but these two guys are comparable. So it's not a weak preorder. The height is infinite because each of these lines has an infinite number of different resources in it. The width is infinite. You can find a line that kind of passes through these guys, and all the points of that line are incomparable to one another. And it's locally infinite in the sense that any two inequivalent resources have an infinite number of resources between them. So that's the power of monotones. You know, you find a couple of non-trivial monotones, and you've suddenly resolved all these questions about the preorder. It happens to be that for this two-parameter family, these two monotones are complete. There's no ambiguity anymore as to how two resources are ordered. The yellow are the ones that are incomparable to R. These are the ones that you can get to from R. These are the ones from which you can get R. These are the ones you can get to. But in general, to answer a question earlier, these two are not enough. And we can prove that you need at least 8 independent monotones, even in the simplest case of CHSH with binary inputs, binary outputs, at least 8. And maybe many more, possibly even infinite. We don't know. But there's an interesting question of how many more you need. And that means that there's at least 8 different types of non-classicality, even in this very simplest scenario of the Bell experiment. All right. I have one or two more slides. So if you just ask, what about the quantumly realizable guys? Turns out that there's a boundary, right? So everything above this can't be realized in quantum mechanics. But all the conclusions we said about the preorder hold for these quantum guys as well. It's not a total order. You need at least 8 monotones. All the same stuff goes through. Now you get one new feature, which is that at the top of the order, you have a continuum of states. You don't have a single state like we did here, or a discrete set of states as we did before. You have a whole continuum of states. So that's interesting. And then finally, let me just note that this point is the thing that violates CHSH as much as possible. And this point is Hardy-type correlations, if you're familiar with the Hardy paradox. And in this perspective, they come out as being both maximally non-classical, but maximally non-classical relative to different measures of non-classicality. So the Hardy box is not less non-classical than this guy. It's more non-classical if I measure by this second monotone, right? Because it goes all the way out to this boundary. And it's less non-classical if I measure by the first monotone. So interesting open question. If we're trying to talk about resourcefulness of correlations for computation, is one of these two monotones somehow more relevant than the other? So for example, if we just go to that simple Anders Brown setup where we're doing measurement-based computation and we're using PR boxes, well, in that case, this guy maximized both monotones, the CHSH and the NPR one. So if we have a slightly more realistic example, maybe we could settle the question of what type of non-classicality is relevant to what type of computational problem. So as you see, we've only kind of touched the surface of this computational problem. Let me just conclude that we found that violations of these facet-defining bound inequalities, although they can be used to witness non-classicality, they're not enough to quantify it, right? We needed other monotones besides just the amount of violation of Bell inequality. And there's lots of work to be done. There's lots of questions, even in the simplest case. We don't even know how many monotones we need. We can go to multiple parties. We can go to other causal structures. And I think there's a large stretch of work between this and, you know, realistic models of computation. But hopefully, this is a useful starting point. So thanks.
Questions for Ron?
So in the first part of your talk, for a microsecond, you flashed a paper reference with Dennis Rosset in it.
I did it? Yes.
So my question is there a symmetry angle to this? I mean, when parameter spaces, does symmetry come in here somehow?
So symmetry comes in, if you look at the details of, as I mentioned briefly, that we have this technique that we call the inflation technique for deriving inequalities for generic causal structures. So this is work with Tobias Fritz and Ellie Wolf. So what you do in that technique is you know, here's your actual causal structure, and now you draw a new causal structure which duplicates some of the nodes in the original, and it just demands that every node has the same kind of causal ancestry as it did in the original. So like every node sort of reproduces its past, so the things that determine how it's going to be distributed are the same as they were in the original. So all the single variable marginals end up being the same, and then you can show that, well, some of the two variable marginals are going to end up being the same as well, because the ancestry of that pair of variables is appropriate. And so you can start getting, you can take some really simple tools for finding inequalities there and pull them back to here. Now, one of the things you can do is leverage symmetries there. You can say, well, you know, the different copies of a variable here all kind of respond similarly. And so there's a lot of symmetry. So when you're trying to find the constraints over here at the inflation level to pull them back, you can make heavy use of symmetries there. And so Denis, in particular, has been interested in leveraging all the symmetries that you can to get the strongest constraints as possible in your causal model. So that's a connection with symmetry, and maybe not the standard one, but.
I wanted to ask a question, but first to add to this, because the Denis, the inflation is based on a definite kind of representation, so implementation symmetry.
Yes.
Yeah. My question is totally different. So the machine learning people you mentioned, they of course also looked at quantitative measures, like, I don't know, it's like average causal effect of that you have to add between two previously independent nodes to explain a certain correlation you see. So again, that's a monotone. Does that at all relate? I mean, if you now systematically construct these monotones, do you find what people like came up with before? Can you
Well, so I think to get to that sort of result, you would need to find quite a different resource theory than the one we're actually defining. So we're not saying, so here's a resource theory I could define. I'm interested in the amount of causal influence between, say, Alice's lab and Bob's lab.
Yeah.
So what am I going to allow for free? Well, I'm going to allow stuff that's based on a common cause, maybe stuff that has communication from Bob back to Alice. You know, I don't care about any of that. And the only thing that's expensive is the Alice to Bob causal influence. So everything that's left over from the free set, that's expensive. Let's find monotones for that. But the project we are engaged with here is we say, well, look, common cause is just in the background, right? We're only interested in things that are common cause. There's no possibility of causal influence between the two because they're space-like separated. What's expensive are things that need a quantum common cause, and what's free are things that require a classical common cause. And we want to know what's the structure of the non-classical things, okay? So there's just no possibility of measuring cause-effect influences in this kind of resource theory. You would need an enveloping theory that included them, and you need your free theory to include everything that wasn't the causal influence that you're interested in. So we are interested in developing those kinds of resource theories. So Tomasz, who's here, has been thinking a little bit along those lines, and others in the group. But yeah, this is not that kind of resource theory.